From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. When Zadie Smith brought out her debut novel, White Teeth, 5 years ago, she turned the literary world on its ear. Her sprawling, rambunctious book was filled with characters who lived in her native London, modern London, filled with people thrown together in the mix of a very multicultural city. Her wit, clear eye, and enormous talent for sharp cultural commentary and satire left critics calling her the Charles Dickens of the 21st century, but with an energy that was all new and alive. White Teeth won a raft of awards, went on to become an international bestseller, and turned Zadie Smith into a literary sensation. She was just 25. Now Zadie Smith has turned her attention across the Atlantic to America, to the clanging cultures, races, religions, and politics of the United States. Her new novel, On Beauty, takes a warm-hearted but unflinching look at America's culture wars, the battles between liberals and conservatives as they're played out in the ivory towers of American universities and lived and felt on the American street. This hour On Point celebrated young writer Zadie Smith and her new novel, On Beauty. And later in this hour, in the wake of the weekend's war protests in Washington, we'll hear from Pulitzer Prize winner Francis Fitzgerald and former Navy Secretary James Webb on how the Iraq War home front is like and unlike the Vietnam eras. But first, join us for a conversation with Zadie Smith. Are you ready to ride with Zadie Smith into the American culture wars? Is this the smart send-up of the pious PC and pompous reactionaries you've been waiting for? Join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from New York is Zadie Smith. Her new novel is On Beauty. Zadie Smith, thanks for being with us.
Hello.
It's wonderful to have you.
Thank you.
You've brought your eye to our side of the Atlantic this time. Can you tell us how that happened? Why?
Well, I guess I was living in America for a while, And I had an idea from the beginning that I wanted the book to be split. So a lot of it does happen in London and in my area of London.
Mm-hmm.
But it was just a lovely thing to live somewhere else. You know, I've lived on the same street my entire life. So it was a cultural shock to move, and it was very fruitful for me, I think.
When you spent, I guess it was 2002, 2003, you spent a year in the U.S. In Cambridge, Massachusetts. I mean, a lot of this is answered in the book, but tell us for the air, what was it that jumped up at you about American culture, the American moment, compared to where you'd come from in the UK?
You know, actually, one of the most direct things wasn't particularly cultural. It was natural. I come from a very urban center, and that part of the East Coast is incredibly beautiful. The landscape is gorgeous. Mm-hmm. The trees are amazing. The clouds are very bright. Everything about it kind of struck my eye, and it started me thinking that I wanted to write a book which was a lot more visual, maybe, than some of my other stuff has been. So it's quite an awakening to my sight, and I think everything in the book to do with paintings and art came from that.
You're, I guess, kind of co-protagonists here at one level, two professors, each of whom are experts in Rembrandt and his painting, but from very different cultural or political bents.
Right.
Are at the heart of it. So you've got lots of opportunity to talk about the visual here, and you do.
And I think it also, I was interested in their academic lives, but the thing which was really pushing the book is there's a wonderful idea of E.M. Forster's that he says that the personal is the real forever and ever. And I was kind of interested in how, no matter what people profess publicly, it's really how they behave in private amongst their families and with their friends. That's what's important.
And yet you put that up against the kind of battle lines of the culture war. You've said that you eventually kind of picked up the model of E.M. Forster's Howard's End as a format here and brought it very up to date, almost a century later. But you take these two men and their families and you put them on each side of the battle here. But not as Americans, interestingly. The liberal Rembrandt interpreter, Howard, a Briton. The conservative Rembrandt interpreter, also a Briton from Trinidad.
Via Trinidad.
Via Trinidad. A wonderful twist to put them in the middle of what we think of as our battle, but from afar.
Yeah, no, I think it's a general battle. I think when you're in America, though, you are pushed towards stronger political views because the culture is very you know, clearly split and radically split. And I know when I was here, I felt more than ever the pressure to express myself politically in a way that I don't normally do, to be honest. And that interested me, and it interests me, the idea that people are so willing to put so much of themselves on the political line, and that's not always in keeping with their more private feelings. It's a very public country in that way.
Do you think, does that indicate less cynicism than in the UK, more public engagement, or just a greater, I don't know, social pressure to take a stand?
I think there's more interest and there's less shame. I mean, England is ruled by general embarrassment, and we also have political embarrassment. And at every point, we try to avoid putting ourselves on the line politically. I think that's true.
I wonder if you'd give us a little flavor of how the drama begins to unfold here with a reading, Zadie, if you'd be kind enough.
Absolutely.
There's a bit on page 44 where the son of the liberal American family, and it is like your own, a kind of biracial family, English father in America, African-American mother up from Florida, children of those two dealing with their parents and all they've brought to it. One of the sons, Jerome, has gone to the UK for an internship and ends up living with the very conservative family there, the Kippses. And you write about how this son of this liberal American-based family responds to this very conservative family. I wish you'd read a bit for us.
How could he explain how pleasurable it had truly been to give himself up to the Kippses? It was a kind of blissful unselfing, a summer of unbelsey. He'd allowed the Kippses' worlds and their ways to take him over entirely. He'd liked to listen to the exotic, to a belsey, chatter of business and money and practical politics, to hear that equality was a myth and multiculturalism a fatuous dream. He thrilled at the suggestion that art was a gift from God, blessing only a handful of masters, and most literature merely a veil for poorly reasoned, left-wing ideologies. He'd put up a weak show of fighting these ideas, but only so that he might enjoy all the more the sensation of the family's ridicule, to hear once again how typically liberal, academic and wishy-washy were his own thoughts. When Monty suggested that minority groups too often demand equal rights they haven't earned, Jerome had allowed this strange new idea to penetrate him without complaint, and sunk further back into the receiving sofa. When Michael argued that being black was not an identity, but an accidental matter of pigment, Jerome had not given a traditionally hysterical belsey answer, try telling that to the Klansman coming at you with a burning cross, but rather vowed to think less of his identity in the future. One by one, the gods of the belseys toppled.
Zadie Smith reading from her new novel, On Beauty, and there we've got young Jerome Belsey, son of the liberal American family, in the bosom of the family of Monty Kipps, the conservative UK academic who that whole family moving right into later in the story into the States and near range. Gosh, you have an awful lot of fun with this, Zadie Smith. It seems like you just sit down and have a ball at the typewriter or the computer keyboard.
Yeah, I did have a lot of fun this time. I really enjoyed myself, and I think a lot of it is based on the absurdity or the accident of birth, and I often feel that. Like my husband, for instance, is Northern Irish, Protestant from the north,
right.
Having all the usual views of a Protestant from the north, and to know, as anyone who's born in that situation, that you need only be born 2 miles down the road to believe absolutely the opposite of everything you presently believe is kind of insane, and even though you know it's insane, it doesn't make any difference to the way you feel and the things you believe, and I'm as subject to that as anybody. So I like when I write to imagine what would it have been like if I'd been born 2 miles down the road, a different family, a different culture, different ideas, in a religious family, for instance. My family is so insanely atheist, it's quite oppressive at times. So I like to make a jump, try and imagine what it would be like.
It's Frank Rich writes how you are merciless about both of these icons, the liberal father, the conservative father, or as he puts it, the fatuous postmodernist and the self-satisfied capitalist alike. What's the kernel of your critique of each of those positions?
I don't know if it's particularly original, but in English novels, certainly in the English comic novel, I always think the biggest crime that a character can commit is to be very certain of anything. And the writers who are particularly good at that, Forster's one of them, obviously. Austen, I think, maybe even better. She dreaded certainty in people, people who felt they knew exactly what the deal was. And I suppose I have a similar dread. I'm very uncertain and I'm unnerved by people's confidence sometimes.
So what's the face of the fatuous postmodernist that gets your teeth on edge or gets you uneasy?
You know, I speak from personal experience. I was a fatuous postmodernist, and there's a lot remaining of that in me. I was a student of French theory and a very, very keen one. So I guess when I went to Harvard, what it reminded me of was my own student days. And I realized when I started teaching at Harvard, I had some incredibly bad habits that were left over from my own education. So it was a great lesson in becoming less certain and being a lot more open.
You're very.
And I actually think American universities are a lot more open than British ones.
Well, we'll have to look at that. But the conservative side, you're tough on as well. I mean, you put the bombast label all over Monty Kipps, the great conservative icon here. What was the heart of your critique in that direction?
Well, there is also a problem with certainty, though. There's a certain kind of perverse conservatism that I have some sympathy for, and which amuses me. There's people like Oberon Waugh in England. That kind of perversity I don't completely detest, and I'm irritated by novels and thinkers who dismiss conservatism out of hand. There's always something to be said from it for every strain of thought. But Monty, no, he is a very pompous man, there's no doubt about it. And he's a very hypocritical man, but no more or less so than Howard, I hope.
And both of them on great comic display with their families and everything that ensues. Zadie Smith, we have to take a short break here. I hope you'll stand by there in New York.
Absolutely.
We're talking with celebrated young novelist Zadie Smith about the culture wars, race, American academe, and a whole lot more. It's all in her new novel, On Beauty. You can join us. Were you smitten with white teeth? Have you thirsted for a wicked send-up of the pious PC and the pompous reactionaries of our time? And is academia as bad as all that? Is it worse? Maybe this. Has Zadie Smith moved beyond race with her mixed families and crazy quilt, or into the heart of it? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with novelist Zadie Smith about the culture wars, race, American academe, and her new novel, On Beauty. You can join the conversation. What do you think? Can you hear E.M. Forster's cry to only connect beneath all the drama in the work of Zadie Smith? Can you hear why the Dickens comparison gets attached to this young writer? Do you see it? Do you read it? Do you hear it? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Max is calling from Colorado Springs, Colorado. Hi, Max. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, what do you think? What do you read here, Max?
Well, I just wanted to say I really loved Autograph Man and White Teeth, and it's an honor to talk to Ms. Smith, which I forgot to say hello to. Hello.
Hi, Max. How you doing?
Amen. We're with you there. And what are you thinking this time, Max?
Well, I'm a senior in college, and I'm worried that I'm not being taught how to think openly. And so this new novel and the open-mindedness that Ms. Smith is being a proponent for is particularly appealing to me. And I was wondering if maybe she could go more into what we young students need to keep in mind as we grow.
Zadie Smith, you're being called on as the graybeard. Advise.
Oh, wow.
Max wants to know what you've got to say.
You know, when I went back to Harvard, I found that it was me who needed the teaching. I was taught in a very strict, from the mount fashion, where the professors are geniuses and you come to praise and to worship. And when I came to teach at Harvard, I thought that I had to teach in the same style. And my students immediately made it clear to me that they weren't having any of that. And we had much more of a conversation. But it depends what subject you're studying, but I just find in literature classes that people feel the need to make of literature a science, and they give it a language that maybe is not natural to it. And my students reminded me that literature is something that you must speak with affective experience of. It's about having a love of this form, and you have to find a language that's appropriate for it. Using some new scientific jargon for it is not quite correct. It's fine for physics, but it's not okay for taking a good look at Bleak House.
Mm. Keep it close, keep it real. Max, we hear your unease with what you're being taught. What do you think you're missing?
Well, I think as a student, we're taught, we're filled up with knowledge, whether it be the theoretical French literary jargon. It's just a different vocabulary, and what I find myself lacking is an ability to see things from a different perspective, which is why I liked White Tooth so much, because you get such a 360-degree angle. And it's hard. It's easy to read stuff like that,
yeah,
but it's hard to see it.
No kidding. And when you find a writer who does with the clarity of Zadie Smith, it's a real joy. Max, thanks for your call. Zadie Smith, how about it? I mean, you know you've got much more than a knack on this front. You see how people respond to it. You're an interpreter of what you see. How do you interpret your own kind of great radar on this identity front?
Oh, man, I feel like I'm being really heavily flattered today. It's all very nice. But I don't really feel like that. I feel like when I sit down to write, I try and make a stretch to imagine how other people will feel. But writing is a lot about failure. Sometimes you can't make big stretches. And I when I wrote on Beauty, there's a lot of characters I wanted to cover, but some characters fall by the wayside. There's this wonderful quote I read recently, Virginia Woolf talking about Dickens, and she said he was very willing to throw a few minor characters into the fire if he wanted to make a blaze.
Right.
And that is a very bad habit of a lot of novelists, and I have it too. You know, sometimes you bring a character into being and you try hard, but then you'll get tired or your will goes or you let something fall by the wayside. So
well, you do that. You do that. You bring them up and let them go.
Yeah.
I mean, some people complain about that.
It's completely.
Too many wrinkles in the cloth, but it's a beautiful cloth.
I think sometimes, you know, you have to break a few eggs to make an omelette. And I do want to try and get as much of life as I see it in. And that means making a mess sometimes. But I always think of literature as an incredibly wide church. So when I want to read the very detailed picture of one man's life, I might go and read someone like Coetzee, for instance, who's incredibly astute about taking one consciousness and unwrapping it for you.
Right.
But that's how I satisfy myself, is I go to different writers for different things. And when I write, I don't expect to please everybody. That, to me, is impossible. I can only do my little world in my little way.
Coetzee, with his 2003 Nobel Prize, doing some great work himself.
He's a hell of a writer, yeah.
let me ask you, and I don't mean this in the realm of flattery, so put that aside. And if you can look at it as an interpreter of literature, I mean, you studied at university. Why do you think this Dickens tag gets put on you first? What is it about the way you write? What do you hear when you hear people making that comparison?
It's incredible to me because when I grew up, Dickens was a hero to me. He still is. I think it's probably just our Englishness, and that in both writers, there's a lot of the same reading. I think English literature, it's been said many times, is split between a kind of Tristram Shandy Dickens route and a much cooler and more kind of Apollonian Austin route, where the writing is controlled and tightly ironical.
Mm-hmm.
And I do come from the messier side of my country's literature, and Dickens is the greatest proponent of it, so maybe that's where the similarity comes. But also just basically because I'm a fan, and anybody I'm a fan of turns up out in my fiction sooner or later.
And E.M. Forster, the huge presence behind this book on beauty, you say the entire book is indebted to him. How do you describe why or how that's so?
Well, I think when I went to college, one of the things I became was extremely intellectualized, or at least I put more credit on the intellect than anything else. And sometimes when you sit down to write a novel, though intellect is obviously helpful, it's not the only thing you need to write. You can't write books with only that. And Forster was the first writer I loved, and when I came back to him a few years ago, I realized that he may not be the greatest mind in literature, but he's one of the greatest novelist, because he had an intuitive sympathy for other people, and that is one of the biggest things you need. So I read Forster to remind myself of that, and to remind myself what a novel is there for. It's not just to dissect a culture or to make an argument or to give you a lot of information. It's a human product, and it has a lot of joy in it, and I think that's important to remember sometimes.
Pretty good description of this novel on beauty. Scott's calling from Iowa City, Iowa. Hi, Scott. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Hey,
love
Scott.
The show. Loved White Teeth. Looking forward to the new book.
Good.
Especially because in the political climate we have, I look forward to anything that tries to pry the argument away from the polarizers on the left and the right. So bravo for that. I have a question about White Teeth.
Yeah.
When I heard you were going to be on the air, the thing that popped into my head was something that I took away from that book. It was one line. I forget which character said it, but it was the notion that tradition is more oppressive or can be more oppressive than religion. It was, and I'm interested in that distinction you made. You know, like cultural people often say, well, you know, religion is this oppressive force, but you made this distinction. And while I know that they're kind of closely intertwined, but you did make a distinction between tradition and religion. And in that book, I mean, that's really brought the whole thing into focus. And I just wish you could expand or, you know, give me a little bit on your thoughts behind that and maybe how it might apply to the new book, if it does. And thanks for your great writing. And I'll I'll see you here.
Thank you, Scott. Zadie?
Well, I guess I think that religion is subsumed within tradition. Tradition is the larger entity. And my feelings about it are very mixed. They wear in white teeth and they remain so. I think tradition is what is left behind, and there's no point in human life if you don't care about what was left behind. And I am, of all things, an incredibly traditional writer, always aware of my history. And actually, that's a very good example. That's the great engine of my writing. At the same time, sometimes it's really oppressive. It's hard to always think, well, there was Nabokov, and well, there was Dickens, and well, there was Green, and, you know, that's not always the cheeriest thought when I sit down to write. Mm. And I think in White Teeth, it's similar. Those kids in the book, their tradition, their cultural tradition is everything they have. And at the same time, it has to be I'm going to use an American word, an enabler. Mm. It can't just be a hand around your throat. So for me, tradition is something which is always moving and shifting, and you have to be open to it, never to turn away from it, because I think tradition is all that we have, but not to let it stop you existing in the present. That's a very hard balance to make.
Of course, in White Teeth, you had these two World War II veterans and friends, Archie Jones, the Englishman, and his best buddy, Samat Iqbal, and you put them into the stew of very familiar terrain for you there in London. This time, you've moved it all to the States. Britons like to say the Americans don't have tradition. Do you see tradition playing out differently in the U.S.? Was that your experience? What's your insight there?
Well, you know, all kinds of nonsense is spoken about America and Britain. Mm. I don't listen to any of that. But I find America a place steeped in history. I was just talking to a friend of mine, Sarah Val, of course, an NPR.
Yeah.
Speak all the time. I saw her last night, and she has, seems to me, the whole of American history in her mouth all the time. And that
meaning
is... It's just she knows everything. She knows every date. She knows every war. She knows everything. And there are a few English writers, I think, of her age who could come anywhere near knowing anything about their own history, and I am included amongst them. So I like that strain, particularly in someone like Sarah, who is a liberal, absolutely, but also an avid historian of her own country. And I like it when those kind of things go together. It's awful to me to think that if you're liberal, you have to slough off your interest in your own country's tradition. I don't see how that works. That's a kind of polarization I'm not interested in.
And what's the critique of your home country? I mean, you've been quoted recently as pretty critical of Britain on a number of fronts, and speaking rather positively of the U.S. in spite of this huge send-up that you're giving here in On Beauty. What's the home critique you make?
When I think about England, I have such a love of it and such an affection for it that when anything in it changes, I'm completely devastated. And that's basically the deal. You know, I do find I can't really take the television, and I get a lot of the magazines depress me. But that's because the country itself is of the greatest importance to me. And I know I might be turning into a young fogey. I can already see it happening. But I knew I would be like that. And it's a love of it. When anything changes in somewhere you love, you freak out. But also, the thing about England is that sometimes you panic that things are changing so quickly, but you just need to get in your car, drive 2 miles north, or go to Devon, or go to the Wiltshire. Things don't change that quickly. It's just when you're in London, you think suddenly everything you love is disappearing. It's not true. England's still there. In every village, it's still there.
Zadie Smith, reactionary. Let's get another call. We're at 1-800-423-8255 with novelist Zadie Smith. Her new novel is On Beauty. Michael is calling from Watertown, Massachusetts. Hi, Michael. You're on the air.
Hi. A very quick comment on the last caller. A difference between religion and tradition is that religions have theologies which can be engaged using reason, whereas traditions basically don't. My comment was a question of what does it pretend for the left in America, we would say liberals, that, and this may just be my own liberal bias, that I don't really see a right-wing author being quite as fair to both sides. Those on the right that I've seen have a tendency to generally just, you know, have received tradition, received culture, or received religion, and received nation, and it really matters where you're born. You know, you'd better be patriotic.
Right.
And so the question is, can the left get anywhere if we're going to be so, you know, fair to everyone?
Michael, don't go away. Let's have you listen and respond. Yeah. Zadie Smith?
I really don't. I know exactly your argument. It's the same thing I hear everywhere, and it's what I feel completely, but my gut tells me that the great openness of liberal thought is not to be left behind. It's our great achievement. And I was reading somewhere, I can't remember who was saying it, but how did it happen that the narrative of the right is so strong at the moment? It was liberals who brought about the redemption of slaves. It was liberals who changed the position of women all over the world. These are great things, and you need to celebrate them and be open to them. And I don't think it helps to get dogmatic, to get singular, even though it feels like the path is hard at the moment. It feels really tough. I think we have to stick with the principles that have sustained us for hundreds of years.
But Michael looks
and
at you.
Even maybe get broader.
Michael reads you and he reads a kind of magnanimity here that he's saying he doesn't see reciprocated. What do you say?
I think you have to give to the reader their own brain and their own faith. So if I have an intelligent reader, I don't need to say to them, look at a man like Monty Kipps, look what he does. Mm-hmm. The reader can do that for themselves. Mm. And dogmatic writing doesn't help anyone. Dogmatic thought doesn't help anyone. So even though it does feel despairing, I think of myself, I guess, as a liberal, and I continue to try and be as open as possible. If you can't fight people you don't understand. You have to try and understand where they're coming from.
I'm all about that. Michael, Zadie Smith is in a way saying keep the faith. Is it sufficient? Are you bolstered?
Two ideas. One, the right seem to be doing quite well without understanding anyone
yeah, you're right.
else. And the other thing is that perhaps people like you, and I'd over-compliment myself to say people like me could continue to write the sort of things you would write, but maybe we also need a few fanatics on our
yeah,
end,
absolutely.
At least to provide a length scale so that we don't look quite as fanatic. These days, you can call any American to the left of, let's say, Bill Frist, a communist because there are no communists against which to compare us.
We got
I think
it.
There are, yeah. I was just going to say, I think there are areas where fierceness needs to happen. The clearest one for me is environmentally. Liberals have to scream from the rooftops. There's no time to be talking about different opinions on what is obvious science. For instance, there is a case where I don't think anyone wants to be shilly-shallying around anymore. We all have to be determined on that road.
We hear that, and at the same time, I hear loud and clear what you're saying about understanding the whole spectrum of views, including the Monty Kippses. Pay attention, pay close attention, figure them out. Michael, thanks very much for your call. Zadie Smith, you raise a couple of things there, the history of women and the history of slavery. First, maybe on women, the two strongest characters in the book, not in terms of characterization, I guess, but in the way you show them living, are the women, the wives of these clashing academics. Kiki, black wife of the white Englishman living in the ivory tower in the States, and Colleen.
Yeah.
Colleen, yes, the wife of conservative Monty Kipps. What is it that you is this a an instinctive giving to the women of this greater strength? Is this your considered judgment? What are you describing there?
Well, you know, this is one of the things. This book has been a lot of, there's been a lot of development for me in the way I feel about things. And one of the things I realized when I started is I've always called myself a feminist before anything else, but I've never really liked women that much. It suddenly dawned on me that most of my books are filled with ciphers of women and women who barely exist, and that I was always very terrified of the girls I grew up with, and that all my friends were men. And then as I got older, particularly in the past 5 years, I have more and more female friends, and I understand how incredible women are. And I realized that maybe I just didn't like teenage girls, because teenage girls can be pretty harsh.
Do you see them as exempt or above the culture war at some level? Or
I just think that there's something about women as they get older, and this is completely a personal bias, but I just see it in the women I know in their 40s and 50s, that they have... often when they have children, they have a much more direct understanding of their mortality. It just seems to me that it's loud and clear when you're 45, when you're 50 as a woman, what life is and where it's going. And for men, I think maybe it's harder to understand.
And so great structures get built, whether or not they're connected to all that understanding.
Absolutely.
Zadie Smith's new novel is on Beauty. We've got a few more minutes with you, and we're looking forward to it. You can join us. What do you think? What do you make of this young English novelist's take on America? And can you hear E.M. Forster's cry to only connect beneath all the drama here? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, B-I-C-O-N.com, and Private Wealth Management at Babson Capital. For more than 60 years, helping clients build and preserve wealth through financial planning, investment management, and trust services. In Cambridge and on the web at BabsonCapital.com.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with the celebrated young novelist Zadie Smith about the culture wars, race, American academe, and a whole lot more in her new novel On Beauty. You can join us. Were you smitten with white teeth? Have you thirsted for a wicked send-up of the pious PC and the pompous reactionaries of our time? Do you hear it in On Beauty? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Zadie Smith, I wanted to ask you about what you saw in the kind of race interactions in the U.S. I mean, you've got this peculiar thing here where most of the action takes place in the States, but you've got a melange of people from all over the place doing it, so it's not strictly American in the way that it unfolds. Still, with your experience growing up with an English father and Jamaican mother in the U.K., you've now projected something like that structure onto at least one of the families in this novel. How do you see the race lines and interaction working in the States on their own and compared to your home countries?
I don't really know. It's so different that I find it hard to make conclusions. I think you have to live here for a long time to know. I mean, the only thing that a lot of people say, and which seems quite obvious, is that if you walk through an American town, there's a lot more homogeneity, that you see black kids with black kids and white kids with white kids, and certainly in Europe that's less true. You see kids mixed up a lot, the friends are mixed, couples are mixed,
not just in London but even outside
the big city.
Yeah,
particularly the mixed couple thing is very, very common in England, and to brown girls like me, we're practically a whole separate race. There's hundreds and hundreds of us. So I felt very normal when I was growing up, and here I think to be mixed race is slightly rarer.
Rarer, though, it seems to be increasingly accepted and even celebrated in the pop culture.
Yeah, which is wonderful. And I remember seeing an episode of Buffy a while ago where a mixed couple was suddenly a completely normal thing. Nobody even mentioned it. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that was true in America about 10 years ago, whereas in England there's never been much fuss about mixed couples on TV or in the movies. But I guess when I was writing the book, I think more about the politics within a family. I try and think about people's day-to-day lives, because it's very rare that you walk through life thinking, I am this socioeconomic self stuck. You know, people don't think that way. You just think, this is my mother, these are my siblings, and it's natural to you. And I did want to show a biracial, as you call it here, family, and the fact that when you're in such a structure, it's life to you. You can't think of it any other way.
And yet there's a kind of class race vector through this that you spend some time on here. The very highly educated kind of ivory tower children of Howard Belsey, you know, taking up the mannerisms of the street and then interacting with young African-American of the street. And you're good at shining a light on the sort of mutual attraction, but also the awkwardness in that relationship.
Yeah, I mean, that really is personal, because I was thinking maybe a lot more about class than race, just because in my country anyway, when you become educated, and obviously I was educated for free, everything changes. And I was once, though it's hard to believe now, quite working class. Mm. But that's all gone. And it went the moment I went to Cambridge. Oh. And that causes strange ripples, you know, just personally, amongst your family, on the streets that you live. It's a funny thing. I speak differently, I think differently, and there's obviously great joy in that, because a whole life has opened up to me that probably wasn't meant for me in a way. But at the same time, you're forever distanced. It's what rappers talk about when they say keeping it real. It's what comedians laugh about when they remember where they came from. It's anybody who ever got an education. It's something is gone forever, and that's a good and also a sad thing sometimes.
Joan is calling from Lowell, Massachusetts. Hi, Joan. You're on the air.
Hey, Joan.
Hi. I have so enjoyed listening to this program and listening to you and about your great gift. I felt like I was caught in a time warp because I was always such a lover of E.M. Forster and Dickens, and felt that there are so few novelists that really understood that the development of a character was so much more compelling in literature or characters than really a story. I'm so happy to hear of a young woman novelist that really understands how it's been really missing from literature. And unfortunately, when I was once a great reader, but with the demands of family and work and all of that, I don't have a chance to read much. But I will pick up your books because I am so encouraged to hear about you. And coincidentally, never listened to the radio at this time. And
is that a kid in the background?
We hear one of those demands on your shoulder, on your hip there right now. Joan, thanks so much for your call. Our time's running short. You will be drawn into this one, I can tell you. Zadie Smith, we've just got a couple of minutes here. I wanted to ask you, we spoke recently with plenty of writers, but Tom Wolfe was with us. Of course, he's written about American university setting recently, but focused entirely differently on the kind of wild sex life and bacchanal of American university life. Now, Ian McEwan was with us, writing about, of course, he's written about sort of the shadow of terror over everything now. Here you are writing in the same time, and yet it's about character and culture wars. Is there a priority list here? Do you see those as the fundamental issue? What takes one writer in one direction and these other long antenna guys in another?
Again, I think there's space for everybody. But what I have noticed more and more, and I felt it when I went back to Harvard, that I and all my students, we had a lot of complex ideas about fiction. We were studying moral philosophy and fiction together. We were interested in it as a form, but in private or when we were at a bar or having a drink, the things which we retained from these books were the characters. You know, people can be moved to tears talking about Elizabeth Bennet, or it's incredible. What stays behind is Penin or Lolita. That's what remains, and I love that about fiction, and I just want a kind of writing and also a kind of criticism that appreciates that what's left behind is the human more than anything else. And what we love in books are the people who we retain from them. So that's kind of what I aim for when I'm writing.
Are you done with the States, or might you live in the US again?
No, I would definitely live here again. I mean, I'll never leave Willesden in any permanent fashion because it's kind of like my kryptonite or something. If I go away for too long, bad things happen. But I'll come to America again, sure.
Good. We welcome you back. Good things happening here. Zadie Smith, it's terrific to have you. Thank you so much for being with us this hour.
Well, it was a real pleasure. Thank you.
Zadie Smith, author of White Teeth, The Autograph Man, and her new novel, On Beauty. For more on Zadie Smith and her novels, go to our website, onpointradio.org. In a moment, a look at the weekend's pro- and anti-war protests through the lens of Vietnam. This is On Point. This weekend saw both anti-war protests and counter-protests in Washington, D.C. Perhaps 100,000 rallied against the Iraq War. A smaller group rallied in war support.
I ain't gonna sit in war no more.
The Iraq War built upon lies. 2,100 Americans dead. Tens of thousands of Iraqis dead.
It's just a reflection of how the tide is turning and people aren't supporting him.
Cindy Sheehan went to Texas with questions for the press.
You're part of history. We need a people's movement to end this war.
Cause he said.
Cindy Sheehan, You don't speak for any of us, not today and not ever.
Bring the troops home now. Bring the troops
home now. Bring the troops
home now. Let me hear you scream. Let me hear you scream louder.
Sounds of the Weekend from Washington, D.C. The latest polls indicate that fewer than half of Americans now believe the United States will win the war in Iraq. And just over 30% polled support the president's handling of the war. The polls and war protests have brought to mind for many the era of national debate over the Vietnam War. To look at how these eras are alike and unlike on the home front, we've turned to two keen observers of both times and both wars. I'm joined from New York City by Francis Fitzgerald, Pulitzer Prize-winning author of Fire in the Lake, The Vietnamese and the Americans in Vietnam. Francis Fitzgerald, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
And from Arlington, Virginia, by James Webb, highly decorated Vietnam War veteran, former Secretary of the U.S. Navy, and author of the recently published book Born Fighting. James Webb, thank you for joining us.
Good morning.
So here we are. We're not trying to compare the wars exactly, but we wanted to reach out and get your readings on what we see on the home front here. Francis Fitzgerald, in form, this was a very familiar scene in Washington this weekend for those who would look back to Vietnam. When you look out on these protests, and even some of the same voices were there, I'm reading Joan Baez was there, what do you see like and unlike the home front in the Vietnam War years?
You know, I think that that they're very different. The protests against the Vietnam War began in the universities. There was always a large component of students involved. And what they were about, really, was calling for an end to the killing of massive numbers of Vietnamese for the sake of propping up a corrupt and dictatorial regime in the South. Mm. They were moral protests. They were largely about the Vietnamese. And the protesters had an uphill battle because most Americans didn't know or care very much about Vietnam per se and saw this as a sort of part of a fight against global communism. In practice, these demonstrations didn't convince the majority of Americans to oppose the war. What changed popular sentiment as registered in the polls was the growing number of American casualties, mm-hmm. and the growing sense that the war couldn't be won in at least at any acceptable price.
And now, compared to that formulation?
Now it's different. The focus here on Saturday really was about the withdrawal of American troops from a war that most Americans can't see any reason for. The demonstrations really weren't about Iraqi deaths, although there was some mention of that. They were about American deaths. And there were many retired military officers, families of those who were killed or serving in Iraq.
Yep.
These demonstrations, I think, are much closer to popular sentiment than the Vietnam War demonstrations were.
And yet there are many fewer of them overall than the country saw at the height of anti-Vietnam War protests.
Well, the Vietnam War was much, much bigger than this war.
Mm-hmm.
That's one thing. The other thing is, of course, the problem of what happens if there is an American withdrawal. You know, protesters against Vietnam could promise peace, and there was peace in the end. There was really minimal consequences for U.S. national security when the troops withdrew. But there are real concerns about what will happen in Iraq if and when U.S. forces do withdraw.
Concerns on all sides. James Webb, jump in here with your own take. When you look out over the country now, look at the polls on the war attitude, of course, the Pentagon's concern, strategists' concern that loss of support could be a real factor in this war, as in any war. When you look at this weekend's protests in Washington and think back to the Vietnam era, what do you see as like and unlike?
Well, first of all, I would have to make a comment about the fact that the Vietnam protests came out of the universities. They did, and one of the big distinctions is that there was a draft.
Yes.
During the Vietnam War, right. And so the people in the age group felt more generally at risk, mm-hmm. whereas so much of the Iraq war is an intellectual exercise mm-hmm. where people can sit back and not have to wake up every morning wondering whether it's going to be their child or their loved one. Some of us, such as myself, have a couple of loved ones involved, and it becomes much more personal. At the same time, I believe, and I've said this all along, that this war is more generally unsupportable than Vietnam.
Why?
Vietnam seems to get a sort of a free pass in terms of the way that it ended. But I go back, and you can look at even in August 1972, which was 8 years to the month after the Gulf of Tonkin,
right.
The Harris survey indicated that the United States population, by a margin of 74% to 11%, still believed that it was important that Vietnam not fall into the hands of the communists. There was a consensus in America that the overall, I won't call it a threat, but the overall issue was a compelling issue. This war was purely a war of discretion, and as a result, public opinion has changed very, very quickly against it.
But Francis Fitzgerald points out, and I wonder what you would have to say, that on the other hand, while the Cold War framework was very strong during the Vietnam period, now there's a real strategic problem if U.S. troops pull out, a tremendous uncertainty and potential risk.
That's really debatable. I really think it is. When you have to measure, and we did the same thing during the Vietnam era, we measured what is the damage to American interests worldwide if we were to end our involvement, and there are compelling arguments on both sides of that issue. I think if I were to give one piece of advice to this administration, not that they are listening, it would be for them to begin the end of this involvement by guaranteeing that there is no desire for a permanent American or long-term American presence in Iraq once we start unwinding this endeavor.
But your basic position surprises me a bit. If you had been in Washington this weekend, James Webb, which protest would you have joined, anti-war or in support?
Well, first of all, I think both of, the idea of being able to stand up in the face of power, it goes to the core of what it means to be an American. And so both sides are speaking their mind. But I was warning a year before we went into Iraq that it was going to end up, in fact, I had a line in a Washington Post article that I wrote where I was comparing the occupation of Japan. I said, in Japan, our 50,000 troops immediately became friends. In Iraq, they will immediately become targets, and they have.
Ouch, that hurts. Francis Fitzgerald, we just got half a minute here. How do you see this culminating?
We're going to have to withdraw simply because the strain on our armed forces is too great to maintain this war at current levels. And things don't seem to be getting any better. In fact, they seem to be getting worse. So we are going to get out. And, this war has damaged our national security already. But I am terribly afraid that that ending it will do the same.
We'll see. Francis Fitzgerald, author of Fire in the Lake, and James Webb, former Secretary of the U.S. Navy, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.